Leaving My Islands of Immaturity. And I'd like you to just do a little imagining with me. Supposing that someone offered you a choice between four types of housing. One type would be a little tiny lean-to attached to the home of a wealthy friend, or maybe an air raid shelter in her backyard. And you could stay there, and she would bring you a food every day, come out and talk to you, and be rather close to your friend. And then a second type of housing that would be offered is a small one-room shack out on the edge of town. And in this place, you'll have somewhat cramped quarters, but your basic needs will be provided by welfare. And there are many ways you can add to your income if you're ingenious enough and unscrupulous enough. Now, the third one is an attractive apartment or home in the suburbs with a rather comfortable living quarters, and your budget will be adequate. It will be, you know, slightly tight at times, like most of our budgets are, but you'll be able to get through with a reasonable number of luxuries. And the fourth one will be an elaborate mansion designed especially with you and your tastes and your needs in mind. And you will be, the company will provide everything that you need. In not just the little, you know, not just in not a reserved way, but in a very lavish way. Well, you think that's an easy choice, but then you think again, not just a minute. What are the prerequisites? What are the requirements? There must be some catch to this, and you're right. In that first little air raid shelter, you will have a safe, sheltered existence, and no demands will be made upon you. And you'll get along rather comfortably as long as nothing terribly unforeseen shows up. Nothing happens to your friend. In the second one, you won't have any responsibilities either. Very few restrictions will be placed on you. And if you are ingenious enough, you'll be able to create a rather appealing lifestyle if you can make the right friends and so forth. In the third one, you will work 8 hours a day, five days a week, and you'll have to shoulder your share of things at home. And then beyond that, you can plan your own life. And in the fourth one, you will be on call 24 hours a day, something like a doctor. The employer does not spell out his demands ahead of time. He reserves the right to ask of you what he wants. But you have it from good sources that he's a friend to all of his employees, that he really cares about their full development, that he provides them many special extras, but he promises that it will be very demanding and very fulfilling. Now, which one would you choose? Well, many of us don't realize that in our spiritual and psychological and emotional lives, we have a choice of four kinds of dwelling. Some of us may be basically living in that little tiny lean-to and feel sort of cramped, but not know what's wrong and not know that there are bigger emotional homes to live in. All of us have inside of us what we might call islands of immaturity that we travel back to and live on with these different kinds of limitations in our dwelling. And we may travel back for 5 minutes or for an hour or a day or 5 days or 5 years sometimes. Or we may basically, at least in some areas of life, be stuck on one of our islands of immaturity. And very likely we have not labeled these for what they are. They're part of sort of an undefined inner blur of reactions, which maybe we don't like them all, but we feel rather justified in them. And I hope that we're going to be able to throw a little bit of clarity into that inner blur this morning that will help us to move on in various areas. You know, it's very easy to look at another person and say, he is immature. If you had to live with him. Or she is so immature. I'm glad that she's not my neighbor. It's very easy to look at other people, but it's very difficult to look at ourselves and admit our immaturity. It's uncomfortable. And then another thing, we have a wrong concept often of what maturity is. We think that maturity is being confident, or being independent, or being knowledgeable, or being sophisticated, or being socially adept and at ease. And these things are not maturity. You know, most of us, at least as far as our own personalities are concerned, are rather content with the status quo. We really don't believe in much change. We'd like to see someone else change, and then life would be better for us. But we believe in the status quo for our own personalities. Someone has said that status quo is Greek for the mess we're in. And some of us do have, all of us have a degree of mess in certain parts of our lives that we still have not recognized and that we need to grow out of or be delivered from. And I hope this morning that we can shatter a little bit of that contentment with the status quo, because we'll be richer if we can. You know, it's in our normal living, it's often the discomfort of living in sort of cramped quarters that make us go to all the trouble of looking for a new house and all the trouble of moving. And that's what happens in our psychological lives. We move on because of discomfort. It's too cramped where we are. Or we feel a great discomfort when we realize I am the immature one. Also, that's why these passages that we read about the value of our trials are very important, because it's often the difficulties and trials that we meet, many times because of our islands of immaturity, that provide the discomfort that will motivate us to grow. And God has put within us desires that need satisfaction. And as long as we can get them met on an immature level, we're probably too lazy to grow. But when we begin to see that I'm lacking satisfaction because I need to grow, that can provide us motivation. So we're going to take a look at several stages of emotional maturation first. In a growing child, each of these stages is an essential part of his progress. And each one lets him move into a bit of a larger dwelling where he has more latitude to move around and where he becomes more than he was before. And I think that some of these things can help us as parents, and I trust they will help us to understand ourselves better. Let's be sure as we go over some of these things not to think primarily how this, oh, I wish so-and-so were here to hear this, or I hope so-and-so is tuned in right now. I think it can give us insights that can help us in our relationships with other people, but we're not going to learn enough to be amateur psychologists and go peg everyone. Or we'll surely turn off people and prevent their growth if we start labeling them. But let's primarily say, God, how do I need to grow? How does this apply to me? After I heard these things, I spent much prayer and often prayed and much thought on, God, show me my own areas of immaturity, because I don't want to stay there. And I still pray that. I'm not standing up here as someone who has this whole thing licked and never takes trips back to those immature, uncomfortable islands. I'm here as a woman with needs, just as you are. And I need your prayers, and I need further growth. Stage one is the nursing stage. This is the stage of total dependence. Here, the baby does not contribute of himself to reality. He gets his needs met simply because he exists and wants. And he lets his wants know in varying ways. But he's totally dependent on reality out there to meet his needs. And in this love, he experiences what we will call gimme love. It's a need love, not a giving love. And normally, stage one begins at birth and lasts for a year or a year and a half. And then life gradually takes a different shape so that the child has to move on a little bit. He's able to toddle around the house and Mama isn't going to run to meet his every need now just because he's there. And in fact, Mama has the audacity to impose a few restrictions. He can't have what he wants right now. Mama says no cookies. Well, we'll go on to that later, what happens when he gets out of this stage. But as he begins to grow and experience restrictions and have some things expected of him, then about the age of 12 months to 18 months, he begins to grow out of this room, of this stage of living. And ideally, this first stage lays a firm foundation in the child's life to feel that he belongs, that he's part of, he has a feeling of togetherness and trust of other people. And the mother does this by being warm and loving and available to meet his needs. She does it by adequate physical stroking and caressing. And she imparts to him, if she's laying a healthy foundation, she imparts to him a genuine feeling, I like you. Now, both in these very early months and as the child grows older, parents can do various things that prevent the child from moving on. Parents can do things that cause the little girl to grow into adulthood, largely living in stage one, even. But we can hinder the child growing on in various ways. One is by being over-solicitous, hovering over the baby, being totally preoccupied with the baby. Daddy might as well not exist anymore, even. And we can be too eager to fulfill every desire that our children have, so that even as they grow older, they don't have to plan and save and work toward getting things. But we overly provide everything that they want, sometimes maybe before they want it. And so they grow up expecting everyone to cater to their needs, like Mama did. They grow up feeling that they should be the center of everything. And various other symptoms that we will look at later on when we consider our adult immature islands. Another way is by being overprotective. The mother can encourage overdependence by anxious attitudes, by excessive sympathy and prolonged concern when the child is hurt, either physically or psychologically. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't have a tenderness, but prolonged concern and excessive concern that encourages wallowing around in the hurtness too long. She may even be afraid to let the child fall while he's learning to walk. And by doing this, she deprives him of valuable lessons in independence and in overcoming pain and difficulty, which are necessary to grow. She may give him incessant cautions. Oh, be careful, you're going to get hurt. Oh, don't overdo, you might get sick. Or, oh, no, you might get in trouble. I'm not saying there should never be restrictions to prevent them from true trouble, but constantly restricting them out of over-concern. Or you might catch a cold, you might fall, and constantly it eats away at the person's sense of being able to cope with life and makes the world seem like a totally dangerous place, so we need an air raid shelter emotionally to live in. We don't grow and develop our capacities. We can do it by expecting too little. As time goes by, the child has to learn to be considerate for the needs of others, considerate for the feelings of others, has to learn to increasingly shoulder responsibility so that they contribute to life. And if they're not taught to do this, they're likely to have at least large areas. Their stage one island is likely to be a big, big part of their daily living. And if we fail to, oh, we can do, we can say, oh, here, let me do it, let me help you, or let me finish it, and feel we're being kind to our child. The child then can develop the feeling, well, I really can't do anything right. I can't do anything as well as mother can. I don't have any areas that I know how to do anything. I can't cope with life. I haven't got what it takes, or else they can take the opposite feeling, the opposite thing. Well, I'm ultra important. I'm a little princess on my little throne, and you should run to meet all my needs. You should cater to me. But underneath, either type of person will have deep underlying fears and feelings of inability to make a meaningful contribution to life, and therefore will not have a truly stable self-image. Sometimes parents encourage stage one by being preoccupied with their personal concerns and interests and maybe their struggles and problems so that they tune out the child. And then maybe the only way the child can get attention is by being hurt or by being a problem in some way, being unable to cope. Sometimes this may be one reason why children have problems in school. Because only that way, then the parents come to sudden attention, and then they feel they, both when the child has problems or when the or in other situations, the parent vacillates maybe between being preoccupied and being overly concerned, maybe out of guilt because they feel they're not really giving the child what they need on a basic level. So then they get all over concerned when there's a problem, and the child may develop a problem-centered attitude in life in order to get any kind of love and attention. Other parents may become very harsh when a problem develops, but the child would rather have negative attention than no attention at all. So preoccupation with our own activities can be one way. Another is by making all the child's decisions and imposing our will and our preferences on the child at all times. Not letting the child make decisions appropriate to their level. Now, if a child is given decisions beyond his level, then he becomes insecure and frustrated because it's too big for him and too frightening. A little child may not, it may take too much of his time and he may not be qualified to choose from all the clothes in the closet, but maybe mother can pick out two or three appropriate ones and let him choose and follow his choice. A little older child may not be able to go to the store and mama says you can buy any shoes you want, but maybe together they can find two or three pairs that would be appropriate, and then the child make the choice. And then afterwards mama better not rethink it and think, I thought it over, I think maybe this one would be better. Or later on say, oh, those were terrible shoes we got. Let the child make decisions in line with his abilities. Another way we can keep a child immature in stage one is by secretly desiring that he be immature. This can be for any child in our family, but maybe even more it happens with the last child, that mama has the last one there needing her, and she doesn't want to let him grow up. Even subconsciously, we can do this. And it may be because we need to be needed or because we want a little doll to play with longer. Another thing we can do is attach labels that encourage immaturity, labels that the child will live up to. Maybe labels such as, oh, Johnny's irresponsible, Johnny's undisciplined, so he lives up to it or down to it. Or maybe labels like, oh, Sharon has no initiative on her own. So she begins to believe it about herself and doesn't develop the latent initiative that's there. Or maybe, oh, Susie is so fragile and gets sick so easily, and so Susie never learns to draw on the reserves of physical strength that are within her to be developed. Another is by demonstrating immaturity. Many times we teach them how by being immature ourselves or acting immature at various points. The second stage is the control stage, or the stage of mastery, manipulation, domination. Extreme undue independence. Here the child is trying to assert mastery. He's trying to demonstrate and prove even to himself that he has some control in life. And he gets here not just because he wants, but because he also makes the environment give him what he wants. Reality still meets all his needs. He's not really giving himself to meet the needs of other people, but he may go after what he wants. Like like the child that Mama says no cookies, so he pulls out the drawers and climbs up on the cupboard and gets his own cookies. If they don't give it to me, I have a prior claim to it, and I'll either make you give it to me or I'll get it myself. And the child can show his domination in different ways, sometimes by being demanding or temper tantrums or being very clever and cute enough to manipulate things to get their own way. And the child's love in this stage is still a gimme love. He's still not really giving of himself, but he's concerned about his own desires and needs. And he may become ultra independent and be proving his mastery. So he doesn't want to, you know, everything is no. And he doesn't want to follow any restrictions. And this stage is usually filled with hostility when he doesn't get his way. He envy is strong. He gets a feeling of being gypped. They don't want me to have the good things in life. This stage usually begins about 18 months. And gets going well, as you well know, about two and a half, continues on to about 5 or 6 in normal development. And there are various things that can help or hinder growth. Ideally, in this stage, the parent should lay the foundation for a balanced sense of independence and a healthy respect for authority. And it's good to have clearly in mind what our goals is. What is the mature position in terms of control that we want to be leading him on to? The mature position is control within limits. This is the way God deals with his children. He gives them clearly defined limits, but much liberty within those limits. He says in one sense, talk all you want, but then he puts a few limits on it. Don't lie, tell the truth. And don't talk all the time. Give the other person a chance. Otherwise, you'll lose your audience. Be loving in this. A few limits on our talking. Don't gossip and spread things that tear down the other person. And within these relatively few limits, we can talk all we want. And with our children, we want to teach them control within limits. They must be allowed some control, some ability to make decisions and freedom to do so, increasingly as the time goes by. But they must be given some restrictions and some control, or else they will never be able to relate to authority. If a child is not allowed some control, he will stay in stage 1, probably. Or always stay in stage 2, trying to assert his mastery and gain the feeling he has some control. But if there is no real control and the parent is really permissive, so that no always means maybe, then he learns control without limits, unless you get caught. Why not drive 100 miles an hour down that 30-mile speed limit just for the kicks if there's no cop to catch you? Because he's gained no inner limits from his parents. Why not take sex or drugs as long as you think you can get away with it? He hasn't learned inner control. And so he has to be given a certain clearly defined restriction and then freedom to make many decisions between it. In the parent's training, including the toilet training, the mother has to move, but wisely and not too fast. Not all of a sudden everything is no, but a few wisely chosen no's, one maybe at first, so that they begin to develop the sense that they can give up this amount of control and they get lots of love from Mama and sort of balances out. The thing that makes the child get over his feeling of being gypped and they don't want me to have good things is the love of the parents that's freely and repeatedly expressed, both physically and verbally. And the good intent of the parent, so that he gets the sense, well, they really do want me to have good things in the safe way, at the right time. If I wait till after dinner, then I can have candy. If I go and pull out the drawer and get cookies when Mama says no because it's right before dinner, then maybe I won't get any cookies for 3 days. And so they learn to give up a certain amount of control, and love is one big thing that helps in this. Here we represent God because God cares more about our welfare than we do our own, and every good gift and every perfect gift comes from Him. And yet He imposes certain limitations because He loves us. He delights to give us what's good at the right time and in the right way. Now, the child learns then in this stage that he can play outside as long as he doesn't go beyond the curb. There's a limit that is enforced. He learns that he can do various things, like he's supposed to wait till after dinner for his candy, and he's supposed to tie his shoes and make his bed and do a few things like this. And some of these requirements and limitations are very frustrating to him. And a wise parent doesn't condemn him for being frustrated or angry. But she accepts his anger, but she says, I know you feel angry, but I cannot let you hit mommy. You cannot hurt other people when you're angry. But of course you feel angry. You want your way, but you'll have to wait. So we want to be careful that we don't let the child feel, I can probably get away with it. It's at least worth trying. Or that we don't, by failure to demonstrate enough love, fail to provide the love that helps them overcome their hostility and yield a degree of their control and the kind of love that gives them control within limits. Stage three is the sharing stage. This is the fair play stage. 50-50. Interdependent. First was undue dependence. Well, it was all right dependence as long as the baby is the right age. And the second is independence. And the third is interdependence. And here, the young person about 5 or 6 begins moving into the sharing stage in a more inner way. He begins giving himself to life. And he expects those around him to meet his needs in return. I do this, and you do that. I do this, and Mama does this. And he gets repayment in various forms. Sometimes it's just praise and recognition and appreciation. And a wise parent will give him this. He gets maybe sometimes service in return or respect for his rights. And readiness to invest oneself in reality to a degree opens the door to stage three. I'll do my part in stage three if you do yours, and when you do yours, and as long as you do yours, or because you do yours, and I expect you to do your part because I do mine. And we work together in the picture of life. Mama does some, I do some. In this period, during the ages about 6 to 9, togetherness with the parent of the same sex is very important. Because they learn to identify with this parent, and I do the same as Mama does, or the son, I do the same as Daddy does. And we get an alike feeling. We do a like feeling, and we're equal more. We're more getting to be on equal terms. Not that the parents do not still have rightfully restrictions and control in a loving, wise sense, but the feeling is more of equality, that we each contribute. And this prepares the child for peer relationships, which are coming up to be very important. In stage three, the child considers himself more equal to others, and he's less selfish. He's no longer the center of everything. They have rights, and they have responsibilities, and I have rights, and I have responsibilities. And the at-home years of stage three should provide a greater competence in contributing to life and to family welfare. The kind of love in this stage is exchange love. Back and forth, 50-50. I'm interested in your happiness, but I sure don't want to miss any personal happiness either. I'll go halfway. I'll share my toys if you share yours. And the little girl says, you know, Mommy, I've invited her over 4 times to stay overnight, and I wonder how... She's only invited me once, and I wonder how many times I'll have to invite her before she invites me again. That's very normal in this stage, but it's slightly immature for an adult. Although well, we'll see that most of us, many of us live in this stage. Normally, this stage, as I said, begins about 5 or 6 and gets going well by adolescence. But it often continues all through life. The majority of the population lives in stage 3. In fact, apart from the Christian position, stage 4 is really just an ideal position that a person can make little trips up into but cannot maintain. But this stage has many limitations. It can never bring that real depth of fulfillment and satisfaction that we long for down in the core of our being. And I'd like to share some reasons why it gives less satisfaction than is possible in life. And one is that the person is still having to make reality give him what he needs. Instead of doing it just by temper tantrums or by manipulation, he does it by achievement, by serving, by giving, at least to that point. But he always has to keep mental accounts, conscious or unconscious, as to make sure that the scales don't tip one way or another. If the scales tip so that the other person makes him go more than halfway, then he'll resent it, and he'll probably end up taking a trip back to stage 2, where I'll make you do it if you don't play the game right and do it for me just because you're mature. Or he may be very uncomfortable if the scales tip so that someone else does more for him than he does for them. He may be very uncomfortable then because he feels obligated. And so it's very hard for us when we're in stage 3. It may be very hard for us to be sick and let anyone take care of us, or get old and have to depend, unless we make a trip down to stage 1 and just wallow a person in stage, when they get sick, can easily make a little trip down to stage 1. Oh, will you feed me my soup, dear? Be careful, don't drip it down my face. Then he gets she gets a little bit better and gets up in stage 2 and says, keep that noise down. How can I get better if everyone's making that noise and his headache's probably getting worse, or hers, because of her shouting than because of the noise? And then as they get well, maybe they basically live in stage 3 again, so we do make trips. But that's a little ahead of our story. But it cannot bring true satisfaction because we always have to keep these mental accounts and always have to make reality give us something. We get very defensive and vulnerable on this stage and are easily, as long as we're in stage 3, easily drugged down to stage 2. Partly because there are people in the world who live basically in stage 1 or 2, and for a person in stage 3, this is terribly uncomfortable. Stage 1 people are clinging vines and just dead weights, and a stage 3 person would just as soon avoid them. Stage 2 people always have to have their own way and have to win all the games and always have to be right. So a stage 3 person sort of wants to avoid them. They cannot have relationships with many people without great discomfort. But even in stage 3, they have problems with someone in stage 3 because someone else may have learned different rules to the game. There may be husband and wife in stage 3, basically, but they learned different rules as they grew up. And so they're always pulling one another down, maybe into a lower stage. A woman in stage 3 may nag at her husband to kiss her goodbye every morning. That's the way Daddy showed love to Mommy, and if you really did it, you'd love me. I do all these things to make you happy, and you should do that to make me happy. So, after a while, you know, women call it reminding and men call it nagging. And after he's been reminded enough times, finally, to get her off his back, he dutifully kisses her goodbye every morning, but she's robbed herself of the love satisfaction because she knows why he's doing it. She's always trying to get her husband maybe to love her the way she wants to be loved instead of accepting the love he's able to give and being grateful that he really does love her, although he doesn't show it just the way her father or a movie star or that other husband does. Stage 3 people are longing for ideal love, and they're trying to get it from another, but each has only exchanged love to give. Each has only this halfway love to give. And so they're like paupers trying to borrow from one another, and they both end up poor as far as the deep, deep, deepest needs of their heart. And stage three love can never flow full and free because it's too interested in two things: limited safe investment and limited liabilities. Stage four is the serving stage, and this is giving without expecting repayment. And you may say, that doesn't make sense. That's not fair. Well, fairness, stage of fair play. That's our stage three response to this is it's not fair. But we have to look into it a little more to see if it's fair. In this stage, a person is willing to give himself to reality without expecting or demanding repayment, either in terms of equal service or recognition or appreciation or reward of some kind. And he is willing to keep giving himself to meet needs out there, whether or not the people in return meet his needs. But he's not doing it out of a vacuum. He's doing it because he has a new primary source of having his needs met. And that source is God. God is the source of unconditional, limitless love. We don't get his love because we deserve it or earn it. We get it just by opening ourselves to him. And as his love comes in and meets the deep needs, in fact, the deepest love needs that no human can ever meet, if we expect our husbands to meet those deep love needs, we're expecting them to be God. We're very, very unfair. Because God has created within us deep, deep love needs that only God can meet. And only his love is big enough to meet. And as we let his love saturate our hearts and meet those deep needs, then there comes an overflow to others. And stage four living is the overflow of that full heart. That is, the needs are being met, but not because we're demanding it or expecting it in specific ways on the human level. I'm not saying that we don't delight in human love. The poor wife that couldn't do that, that said, I've got God, and Christ is the new man in my life now, and I don't need you. That would be ridiculous. Of course, human love is delightful. Human love is one of the ways that God meets needs in our hearts. But if we can accept it out of an inner basic fullness and accept it as the frosting on the cake, then we don't always demand more than a man can give. And we actually probably get far more love back than anyone in any other stage does. Because there's something about this kind of love in stage four, which is expendable love, loving with the other person's need primary and mine secondary. When I live like that, there's something about it that sort of produces love in other people, makes them want to give love back. And I believe that a person who basically lives in stage four gets far more love from other people than anyone else does. But she may not always get it from all the people she wants it from, or in just the way that she would line up if she were living in stage three. And sometimes she may have to go on loving for a long time without feeling the love back humanly. But because she has a new inner supply of love springing up like a well of water within, she's not depleted by her giving. She has a constant replenishment in the love of God and in the strength and power that he gives. In this relation, in stage four, God and I are related in a love relationship in the business of living. And I am to leave my rewards in God's hands. And sometimes I may have to wait till the next life after death, to get my full rewards. But he promises that I will be more than rewarded. God is no man's debtor. And if we let him be God in our lives and let ourselves be his channels to love other people and serve other people, he will see to it that we get far more than we imagined in abundant living and in satisfaction and in fulfillment in many areas. In stage four, a person has conquered the hostility problem. If we are drawn down into hostility, like whenever I feel that sense of resentment in my heart at something my husband may say, or however hostility may rise in my heart, when I maybe give my husband the quiet treatment for a little while, you know, to teach him. Or if we lash out in verbal animosity, if we have our temper tantrums, however we may express our hostility, we are being drugged down into stage two. In stage four, the person has much broader options in relating to other people. He's not stuck in one stage and compelled to react in a certain way. In stage one, if a wife is basically in stage one, she may be a very submissive wife, but the only reason she's submissive is she couldn't make a decision if she had to anyway. And she has no other option. She couldn't live on her own. She, even if she resents having to be submissive, she doesn't know how to live any other way because she's totally dependent. But in stage four, a woman is able to depend upon her husband in a womanly sense and is able to follow his basic leadership in life without feeling humiliated and resentful. That's, in a sense, a stage one dependence, but it's not out of a stage one emotional tone. So it's stage four living, but it can depend. She has this option. A person in stage four is able to control and take the leadership as the situation requires. Of course she must do this with her children, but if she's in stage four, she'll do it because they need to be controlled or they won't grow. If she's in stage two, she'll have to do it because she's threatened and she has to control. And then she's a stage four person is able to be considerate of other people's feelings about justice and fair play. She won't say, well, you should be in stage four so I don't have to think about being fair. No, she recognizes the other person's needs and she seeks to be fair. But she doesn't keep count so that everything is fair back to her. You know, when you've got a big house like this to live in, you probably don't have to act the same way as a beggar in the street. And emotionally and spiritually, some of us live like a beggar in the streets in our stage two or even stage three, you know, carefully counting every little thing because we don't have enough inner resources to go more than halfway. But when you've got all those wonderful inner resources, you don't have to keep track because it's superfluous. And the person is able to give and serve without expecting repayment. You know, we don't automatically arrive at one stage and then stay there the rest of our lives. We make trips back and forth between our islands. And a stage four person can be led back to stage three, maybe by depending upon themselves and not trusting God. And so the inner supply is dammed up. And then they begin to act like a stage three person, and then something happens that triggers their hostility, and they get down to stage two, or they become anxious and get anxiety could be indicate stage three or stage two or one. There's lots of anxiety in these stages because we basically have to look out for ourselves. And basically, we're the chief actor in life to take care of and defend ourselves. If a person is going down, actually going down to stage one, it may show because he won't accept responsibility, or she won't accept opportunities that she really should, or withdraw into a passiveness or an apathy or a depression. Depression is usually means that I've made a trip down to stage one. Various ways that it shows, as we'll see more fully. Let's take a look briefly at these islands of immaturity in us, those uncomfortable offshore islands, those cramped quarters, when we could have a mansion to live in. But we could look at these three more immature stages in our adult psychological makeup as islands within us. As we grew up, things happened to us, and we reacted within in a way that recorded things recorded both pictures and thoughts and feelings in what we might call an inner emotional album. And it's written and recorded there in our brain. We learned in stage one how to depend totally. And it's written there very strongly. We learn in stage two how to gain control, or maybe how to do it sometimes in wrong ways. And maybe in our adult life, when we travel by the speed of thought back to our island one or our page of our inner album that says stage one, or stage two, we probably react much the way we did when we were children. If we were just cute and clever and got away with it, we'll probably now just cleverly manipulate things and maybe never realize we're dominating. If we did it by temper tantrums then and got our way when we shouldn't, we probably will do it by temper tantrums now. We have those patterns recorded in our inner album. And if something happens today and flips open the page to Island 2, and we react according to those old mental recordings. And it can happen in just a flash that we regress back to them because something may happen today that triggers that response or that reminds us of something back there. And some of us may find that we're hung up in one of these islands. We're really stuck. And we don't like it. We try to rearrange the furniture because it's so cramped, and we just get a pass through, and then someone brings in more furniture, and it's frustrating. One of the things that nails our feet to the floor sometimes in our old little shacks back there is our negative emotions, our hostilities, our anxieties, our fears, our self-condemnations. These things nail our feet to the floor. And I do have further, on cassette, further series, further lectures that deal with how to cope with our negative emotions, how to move on and displace them with positive emotions. How can we harness our hostilities? How can we find release from guilt? How can we overcome fear and anxiety? And we will let you, if any of you are interested in some of those cassettes, sign up to them for them. You know, sometimes we find ourselves partly in one stage and partly in another, or some relationship may consistently draw us down to an immature stage. There may be one relationship where we find ourselves just being totally dependent or totally rebellious in stage one or two. And also, sometimes when a person begins to change and to let their emotional life grow, it becomes the beginning of a solution in relationships. Sometimes overwhelming problems in a marriage begin to be resolved when the woman is willing to admit her needs to change, her needs to grow, and start letting God bring that new growth rather than to keep thinking he needs to change. All right, he needs to change. But it doesn't work when we try to change him, try to force him to change. But many times a person does not change because they need a channel of unconditional love. They need a new support for their own identity before they can change. And sometimes God begins to move into a person's life by first moving through a human channel. And sometimes in a Christian's life, God begins to bring more growth by first demonstrating it through another Christian who is living in stage four. And so we can become the beachhead for God to bring new release. Doesn't mean that from the moment we start to grow, the things will get automatically smoother. Because sometimes in the process of the growth, there do arise some areas of conflict that need to be discussed and resolved and so forth. Or sometimes the moment just before dawn is the darkest moment of the night. You know, it doesn't mean that once we start to grow that, boy, now our husband is going to just all of a sudden overwhelm us with a response of stage four love. He may for a while even think that this is just a new tactic to get our way. So it doesn't mean that there are immediate transformations always, but it can be the beginning. But we have to learn, why do we step down into our immature islands? Is it when someone won't cater to our needs? Is it when responsibility comes that we feel I can't, and so we just retreat, or we're in island one? Is it when we can't control people or circumstances to get what we want? Is it when people won't agree with us because we have to be right? Is it that take care about their rights, but they just don't respect mine? And when we detect aspects of immaturity in our own lives or in other people, whether they be large areas or small, it's very important for us to realize that they're evidence of unmet needs. It doesn't help us to sit and condemn ourselves for 5 weeks because we've learned we're more immature than we thought we were. And likewise with other people, if we can begin to see that person who has so much hostility, if we can begin to see that there are vast areas of unmet need down there, then we can take a different attitude and not be condemning toward ourselves or others, but seek to be constructive in the way we view it and the way we move. Sometimes it may be very threatening to think of moving on into opening ourselves out to people in a new way and moving on to a new giving of ourselves, because maybe there's been such a strong message written in there that people will always disappoint you, or people will abandon you or reject you if you let them in close, or people will terribly mistreat you if you go more than halfway. And some of these deep messages in there have to be overcome with truth. And it doesn't all happen overnight, but there can be fears of the risk. It can seem safer to stay in that air raid shelter. And so we have to remember it's deep needs underneath that hang people up. It's not just perverseness or laziness. And then we can therefore be more constructive in our attitudes, both toward ourselves and others, not condemning or judging. You know, if we shut up our hearts and cling to our immature experience, we think it's because we're safer, but the longer we stay there, the more we become destroyed. These immature islands have the smell of death about them. On them, we fail to develop our true capacity to love, and so our capacity can atrophy. We can become more and more just bound into a living coffin, sort of a living death. It's not a choice of deciding, do I want to stay just like I am now, or do I want to go on and grow, though it involves some risk? It's a choice of, do I want to become less than I am, be pulled down more into my emotional prisons, or go on to find the growth and release that God has in mind for me? Do we want to, as we get older, find that those immature qualities of our lives become less and less attractive and more accentuated? Or do we want to grow into beautiful senior citizens? We do have a choice. And it's really not an option if we want any fulfillment in life. But staying on our immature islands is death to true fulfillment. Let's take a brief look at these different adult islands and how they show up. And you have some of this in your notes for you to go over more fully on page 10, 11, 12. And in the future, either within the next month or two or three, I'm going to be making more full notes that will tell a lot more about this. For I think they'll be very helpful. And if any of you want these, we'll have a piece of paper that you can sign up to get them as supplementary notes that I'll mail them when I get them finished. But basically, an adult in stage one is unduly dependent, rather a clinging vine. As we mentioned, she may be submissive, but she has no other choice. She may seek an all-enveloping, all-consuming relationship with some other person, whether it be her husband. It's a possessive, wanting him only for herself and wanting to just be lost in this relationship so she can feel secure. She may want to make herself part and parcel of someone else, someone who will command her and guide her and look after her and cater to her. Now, outwardly, it may take very different aspects. One may be running to everyone for sympathy and rescue. Another may have put on a strong, confident appearance that I'm really a living doll. You should just bow down and worship me a little bit. Or I'm very high on the social ladder, and you should honor me. And there can be an outward appearance of confidence, but down underneath there's a deep sense of not being able to contribute to life what the person really should. The person in this stage doesn't have any genuine deep concern about other people, but may have a great unreasonable craving for affection. And sometimes this kind of love shows up in the feeling, I love you and I can't exist without you. And stage two love will sometimes show up in the same way. I love you and I cannot exist without you, although the reason for not existing without the other person is a little different. That kind of love is not realistic, really mature love. Sometimes a person in stage one can love only one person and may be indifferent to everyone else, and that is not genuine love. It's gimme love. And a woman in this stage may not assume responsibility if she can avoid it. If we flop down to this stage, then we probably try to protect ourselves from all responsibility and quit readily if the situation becomes difficult. I'm not saying that a stage four person will accept without reservation all responsibility. A wife may not be able to give expendable love to her husband if she says yes to everything else. So there are definite limits just in order to be mature and realistically perform our first responsibilities. But a person in stage one gravitates away from responsibility into a passive role that sort of aimlessly drifts through life without real goals that she's heading for. And she tends to like activities, quote unquote, that put her in the role of the non-involved spectator. Passiveness or withdrawing or retreating is very a strong aspect of stage one living. Now, a more mature person does withdraw for good reasons at times. Jesus withdrew into the wilderness from the crowd to have time alone with God. He needed a degree of withdrawing. And a person who is truly mature will be able to withdraw for that afternoon alone or those hour or two in her bedroom with her feet up reading, or on the vacation where she really relaxes, or a degree of different kinds of withdrawing just because it's part of wise living, or we end up depleted physically. But in stage one, there's a withdrawing that's part of the personality hang-up into things like apathy or resignation, what's the use, or a chronic need to lie down and rest, a constant exhaustion that may be part of stage one, or into fantasy, or into television, novels. She may go home to mother. She can withdraw into depression. Sometimes sickness can be a way of withdrawing that is stage one retreat, purposely, but unconsciously maybe. I'm not saying all sickness is, but it can be. And a person here may look very confident, but underneath, underlying, whether it's conscious or not, there's a great sense of incompetence and a deep guilt at not being responsible and giving oneself self to life. And one person may show it by being very self-effacing and self-punishing and self-condemning. Another may show it, may have an outer confidence, but underneath have some of these feelings. And another may take a masochistic pleasure in being abused or pushed around, or maybe this can sometimes be an atonement for the guilt of irresponsibility. Now, stage two island basically is when we need to dominate and we need to control, we need to manipulate. We get things because we want and we go after making people give us what we want. And we can do it in many ways, as we've seen. Another way is by flattery, bribery, threats, withholding privileges or favors. How many wives use this? Making others feel guilty. A mother may seem to be a very self-sacrificial mother. She may just slave for her family, with never a thought of her family, with never a thought of herself. But if she's not doing it out of genuine stage four love, there's probably a lot of complaining mixed in with it. And a lot of feeling, you should really do what I want because I do so much for you. And a lot of deep down resentment underneath. You should take my advice. Parents can be very generous in giving or lending to their married children. But underneath can be the element of control. Stated or not, you should take our advice now because we've done so much for you. And there can be control. Undue need for material security can be an evidence of stage two, because if we have plenty materially, then we can control life. And a person in this stage always has to be right. She might rather break a relationship than admit she's wrong. And if she has to admit she was wrong, she might do it something like this. Well, I must have been out of my mind. In other words, I wasn't really wrong. It was just this little time when I wasn't there. And this stage reveals a deep insecurity, whether the person realizes it or not. The reason hostility comes out or is harbored underneath is because something is a threat to a weak self-image, to a low sense of identity, maybe even to a deep sense of self-rejection and self-hatred. The hostility can come out in various ways of, you know, it can even be toward inanimate objects. Why did they put that pole there where I'd bump into it? They didn't tell me about it. They didn't put up a sign for me, you know. It's not my fault that I bumped into that pole. Someone put a pole in a stupid place. Stage three islands, we said, I'll do my part if you do yours, or if you reward me in some way. A strong sense of fairness and justice. A strong feeling that to give without receiving is being cheated. You know, during their hectic week of moving 3-4 years ago, we had them over for dinner twice. And now that we're moving, I wonder what they'll do for us. It often has a long memory in our account, in our keeping mental records. There's less competition in this stage. In stage two, there's often heavy competition, and sometimes there's a driving need to achieve in some area in order to prove mastery. Well, there's more of a balance in stage three, and there's a little less defensiveness, a little more stability. But we often regress, like we said, because we find too many people who won't follow the rules, won't play the game. And so it easily degenerates into disappointments, our love in this stage, or resentments, or retaliations. Now, in terms of spiritual response, I'd like to just briefly go into these islands. Stage one and stage two are unable to relate to God as God in their lives, as truly God. Because as God, God has some requirements. A stage one person may try to relate to God just on getting comfort and sympathy, but it's a very shallow, unrealistic relationship because God does more than just give comfort and sympathy. He draws us out to become more than we are, and he expects us to give ourselves to life, but he gives all the resources necessary. But the stage one relationship hardly knows how to give herself to God. Stage two also doesn't know how to give himself. We may think, well, we better have God in our lives, at least an outward appearance of religion. You know, sort of like a spare tire. You hope you never need to use him. It's a little humiliating if you do, but we better keep him around, or maybe we better pay a tithe to keep him off our back. You know, sort of pacify him so that we can go on living our own lives. And God is not really God in these stages. Stage three, God gets to us in a more meaningful way. The gospel, the good news of salvation, comes to us in stage three with real clarity, unless we're so caught in this feeling that we don't want more than we earn, so we don't want free as a free gift of salvation. We want to be able to say, I did it. So we want to come our own way by earning it ourselves. And God says that's not the way. But God says, I have given my son. He died on the cross for your sins, to pay the whole guilt of your sins. Now, you give me your heart, open it to me, and I will give you eternal life and forgiveness. Just believe me, open to me, receive my son into your life, and I will give you eternal life. That's stage three. You give, I give, and then he seeks to lead us in our Christian growth on to stage four. Now, we can be a stage three Christian all of our Christian life, and it will show up in various ways. We try to bargain with God. God, I'll do this for you if you do this for me. Or I've been a good boy and you should answer this prayer. Or, you know, it really isn't fair, God, for you to let this happen because I've been a good Christian. You're not being fair. In stage three, the Christian may want to serve God, but still consider himself basically the chief actor. God has given him eternal life and salvation, and now he feels that God has given him the Christian life as sort of a do-it-yourself kit. Now get with it, girl, and see what you can build, sort of on your own. But I'll be here to help you. Call for me if you need me. Well, that's a stage three conception which falls short of what God has for Christian living, and yet many Christians live their whole life on that limited plane. And here, basically, we still are the chief actor. God is not. And basically, we're relying on our own resources, and we miss the reality of all that, those tremendous inner resources that lift us out of this. And often, we often make trips down because we can't, we get triggered, our responses get triggered in a wrong way. Now, God's intention is so much better than any of the insular living, any life on these uncomfortable offshore islands. He has a beautiful mainland with a mansion for us to live in. And we may be well adjusted, humanly speaking, normal, in quotes, but be still on stage three and missing the abundant living that God has for us if we'll just move over and live our lives as fully as we can, with as few trips off and getting back as fast as we can from our islands when we do get triggered down there, onto the mainland where there's abundant life. And there are some prerequisites to living, so to speak, in God's country, which stage four living is. And the first prerequisite is that we really be linked with God and his resources. There has to be a personal relationship with him. He can't just be sort of a pink blur off there, or a spare tire in our cars, or a nebulous, I know about him, I know all the facts about him even. I believe even all the facts that the Bible says about him. It's more than that. It's a personal contact with him, personal relationship with him within. And I came across a quotation that's really beautiful along this line of what Jesus did for us and what and how we can have a relationship with him. It says, in Jesus, God is coming from the everywhere into the here at one particular place in time. Jesus is God rooted in human history. Jesus, the Christ, is God's word, God's long-awaited answer to the longings and desires of the human heart. Jesus stands in the middle between God and man. He holds the divine by one hand and the human by the other. And in his own person, he becomes the living bridge. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. And there's a quality of life that Christ offers and no one else offers. There's a reality of God to which we can come through Christ, and we cannot come to it by any other way. And it's so simple to come to it, just by inviting him into our lives. He will never force his way. He's not in stage two. He will never force us to respond to him. He will seek to draw us, to make us want him, to maybe make us uncomfortable so we will realize we need him. But he won't force us. And he is standing at the door and knocking. And he wants us to just say, I receive you, Jesus, into my personality to be my Savior, to forgive my sin. And the minute we really say that, he says, I will come in, not maybe. He comes in, and then that gives us, we're born spiritually. We receive a new passport that says we are citizens of heaven. We're members of God's very own family, citizens of God's country. And this is the first prerequisite to living on the mainland, having our passport by being born into God's family. And the second prerequisite is that we rely on God's control and resources. When we receive Christ into our lives, his Spirit comes to live within us. And he wants to control us and to produce the fruit of this wonderful love through our lives. He wants to flood our hearts, to meet our deep needs more and more by his love, and then to overflow to other lives. The fruit of the Spirit is love, genuine, unconditional love. And as we rely upon him, that fruit flows through us, or is seen in our lives. You know, we like to, if we're in stage three, what we're doing instead is tying on artificial fruit. Nice little attitude here, a nice little attitude there, and then from a distance it looks rather pretty, but you know, if you try biting into that kind of fruit or smelling of it, it's disappointing. So any fruit we produce on our own in stage three is artificial, and it doesn't bring real satisfaction either to God or to us or to other people. But as we rely upon God, remembering that his life is in us, his Spirit is in us, sort of like that light bulb relies on the electricity to flow through it and the light shines, but has to let itself be screwed in. Imagine a light bulb with a will of its own that says, I want to shine on my own. Well, it's just in the way. Basically, as far as the true purpose for which it was brought, it may be used as a paperweight to hold down papers on a desk. It's not even too good that way. But it misses its basic function, which is to give forth that beautiful light. And so as we rely upon the Spirit of God in us and get and trust him, then he produces the beautiful light of God's love through us. And the third prerequisite is a process of growth. As we realize the wonder of having Christ live in us, having Christ love others through us and fill us and meet our needs on an increasingly deep level, then we have to still grow. Our roots have to go deeper in the soil of God's marvelous love so that it floods up into our whole being. And sort of like when we first receive him, he's like a fragrant little bud, fragrant rose plant with a fragrant bud. And if we stay on stage two, if we stay on stage three, it's like we put that bud in a nice little box and it's not seen, and the fragrance can't be smelled. And then we begin to see that we should let him shed his fragrance abroad in our hearts, and we take him out of the box, and there he begins to show himself. But you know, all through our lives, he unfolds more fully, and there's more fragrance and more beauty as we get to know him better. And there's a process of growth. And sometimes this growth takes place under summer skies with warm sun shining, or in the freshness of spring,